right, today we're going to start going through Roman society. I am not going to blaze through it at the expense of the information. We're going to get through as much as we can of it, as much as that you guys feel like you are understanding of it. Some of it will seem not remedial. Some of it will seem like, oh, I've heard this before. But I'm intentionally starting up here, and then every once in a while we'll be dipping down deeper to kind of put a new, different nuance, specifically regarding honor and shame. Because if you only study the historical documents and you don't add into it the sociology, even I'm talking even of Roman documents, and you don't add into it the sociology, you're just not getting the whole story. Now, what do I mean by that statement? This is a major pitfall of historians and exegetes as a whole. What do I mean by that statement?
Can you say that statement again?
Statement is this: if you only look at the historical documents, asking historical questions, and don't eventually dip into sociology, then you won't understand really what the text is saying at all. You won't get the whole story. Why? What am I saying that statement? What does that statement implicate? Or help me maybe exegete that statement.
Taking the humanity out of the history.
Explain that. Yeah, I like what you're getting at, but explain that.
The history is obviously written about people and their problems, and so if you're not going to talk about people and their problems within that, then you're missing a big chunk of history.
Yeah. Absolutely. A lot of times what we do is that we allow the people on the text to stay flat. We don't allow the people to have emotions like we have. We don't allow people to have different sociological constraints that we have. We've been talking about there's a public transcript, hidden transcript. But sociology in particular is a study of what is in between the text. More than any other study, historians are going to be asking the questions, what does the text say that leads to this? And they're going to be really constrained by the data. But the sociologist is saying, my goal is to look in between the text. What is happening in between? Why? They're not asking just questions of what happened. They're asking, why did it happen in that way? And what does that then reveal about society? And how does that, therefore, what can we extrapolate out to other different interpretations that may affect the way we look at things? Are you following me? Sociology, if you don't eventually get there, you will never really truly understand what the text is saying. So we've talked about the Roman history, which is good. But even when we begin to talk about Roman society, you'll begin to see that the Roman history will start making more sense, as well as the New Testament text. Because the world isn't just which emperor was reigning when. It's how is the society functioning during the time in which that emperor is reigning. So, in particular, we're probably going to be going, there's going to be a couple of things we're going to be restating, maybe even a couple of illustrations we're going to restate, but I'm not going to apologize for that because I want it all in one place on this lecture, so if people go back and look at it, they'll be able to find it. Does that make sense? Honor and shame is the system of the ancient world that we are functioning in. Honor and shame. This is not our dominant currency in our world. This is not our dominant currency. If we were going to establish our dominant currency, we would probably land on time and money. That is what we value. That's what we covet. We try to do the most. We try to get the most amount of money in the least amount of time. As a matter of fact, with that as our goal, sometimes even things like morality goes to the wayside because that's not what we primarily are focused on. We focus on our dominant social currency. What is worth the most is not necessarily morality. Although people will ostensibly act like morality is important to them. If they have to fudge on some of the morality in order to get more money in at least amount of time, they'll do it. Let me give you an example. How many different corporations that are in our country that are functioning export the production of their particular product? Not because they don't want to have it built in America, but because they can get it done cheaper, even if the conditions are ridiculous, and even if the ages of the people that are building things like their shoes or their clothing is borderline child labor, child slave labor. Have you heard of those different issues? For example, the Kathy Lee Gifford debacle with Walmart a decade ago or so. Whenever she has this different thing, and on the tag it says that she every shirt that's sold, any clothing, she's going to be donating it to a child, donating the money. And then come to find out all the stuff was being made by children overseas. What's the issue? The dominant currency of our society is time and money. Therefore, sometimes morality can be overlooked, especially if it's not morality that's impacting people within our country. It can be overlooked in order to achieve these goals. Now, does that happen with every corporation? No, I'm not suggesting that. But what I'm saying is that happens in our society because of what we value. Does anybody have a question about that? Or are we good? Everybody following me so far? As a matter of fact, I had a salesman come to me once, and I felt bad for my response. But he was trying to sell me and my wife something, and it was one of those schemes where you invite some friends over for dinner, and then they bring like this rep, and they like they're a part of some pyramid scheme, and they're trying to get you in on it too. And I was already annoyed because these friends had done that. They basically just kind of slooped us, just totally cut our legs from under us. And so he comes in and he sits down and he goes, "If I could get you more time and more money, would you take it?" I said, "That's stupid. You're going to create time? I'm going to free up your time. I can free up my time. I can quit my job. Then you wouldn't get money. Who said I want money?" But what was his selling tactic? How was he selling me? Tapping into the two things that our society worships the most. Time and money. Most amount of money, least amount of time. That is not the case in the ancient world, nor really in the Middle Eastern world today. It's not the same way. And I've told this illustration, I think, in here. Maybe I have or haven't, but it illustrates the point well. I'm over in the Middle East, summer after 9/11, haven't called home in like 3 days, and it was a big deal because I was only 19. My parents were still freaked out whenever I'd go overseas. At this point, it's just whatever. Shane's gone again. Okay. It doesn't matter. Anyway, that's not late and Freudian anything. I love my parents. Anyway, okay. So I decided, you know, I probably should call them just to let them know I made it. because at that point, everybody was still kind of freaking out over flying airplanes into Middle Eastern countries. So I'm there, and I'm at the kiosk, and I ask for an international phone card. Have I told the story in here? Oh, well, then I'll slow down. I was going to just skim over it. I'm buying an international phone card, and I'm at the kiosk. And I put down my money, and he puts down the international phone card, and I'm looking down, counting my money, and I look up, and the guy is gone. And I'm looking around at the guy behind me, and I'm like, what's going on? And I look over, and I see the guy from the kiosk, and he's running down the street, and there's a whole group of people over here gathered together. And I'm going, what's happening? Like, are we in danger or something? And it's like, no. What's happening is there's two guys that are in an argument. And at that moment, honor is up for grabs. And for this guy at the kiosk, what was most important to him was not the time and money. I could have taken my money and the card and other stuff and left. It didn't matter to him. That's not what's most valuable. What's most valuable to him is honor and shame. Therefore, if there's an opportunity for him to go and be divvying out the honor, that's where he's going to be. And for me, that just didn't make sense at all. I was like, well, what in the world? What's wrong with him? But for him, it would not make sense if he stayed there and completed the sale. Because that's not what's most important. He will get rid of time and money in order to do what's most valuable to him, and that's honor and shame. It's kind of like there were some kids that were really upset with me because we're standing in this pharmacy, and these two girls who could speak Arabic were helping get the different drugs that I needed as well as other people did because of when you travel overseas, things happen to stomachs. And anyway, but we're in there, and all of a sudden the two girls go running out the door. And I'm like, what's happening? You know, and I go over there, and I'm doing this pretty much the whole time. You know, rocks getting thrown at me. I'm like, what's happening? You know, pulled into a back alley at one point. What's happening? It was a good trip. Locked inside of a perfume cabinet at one point. Anyway, where was I at? Pharmacy. They go out, and all of a sudden I go out there, and they're yelling in Arabic. These two American girls that could speak, they're yelling Arabic. Everybody's coming out of their stores. I'm like, what's happening? And this group of kids comes and starts grabbing my hand and starts pulling me down the street. And I'm looking at the girls going, what's going on? Like I thought I was doing everything right. And then finally, one of the other girls came and kind of told the kids to stop pulling me and brought me back. I was like, you've got to tell me what's going on. What happened was one of the little kids had come in and pinched one of the girls on the butt inside of the pharmacy. And what the kids wanted me to do was to go down the street, grab the kid, bring him back, and shame him in front of everyone. I was like, if I touch a kid in America, I'm going to get sued. But over there, it was actually my responsibility to do that. I didn't do it because I was like, I can't do that. There's no way. But in their society, it doesn't matter if I grab the kid and I don't know him. The point is honor and shame is being divided. This is what matters most. Even today. Which is one of the reasons why I say, I don't think we understood what we did when we started this war on terror. Because their value system is different than ours. And it doesn't matter how much money or how much time it takes, they're going to get this back. Not to frighten you, but that's probably the truth. You shame Allah, there's only one way to get it back. You destroy the people that shamed him. Honor and shame. We don't understand the definitions, and as a result, we consistently make blunder after blunder after blunder that compounds the honor-shame problem that we're just not functioning under. Honestly, what I think our government would really benefit from in foreign relations is simply understanding honor and shame a little bit better. The world doesn't function off of our dominant currency, even if that's the one our society looks at. The world functions off of different currency, and we need to understand their currency to be able to relate to them. Same thing with the biblical text. Some of the things in the biblical text you'll think sounds foolish, and a lot of times it's because you're not looking at it through the right dominant currency. That's not the way they function. So let's do some definition. Definition of terms. First of all, we need to define honor, but you need to understand that honor is defined with a sociological equation. There are two elements that you add together, and the addition of these two equals honor. The first thing, honor is the value of a person in his or her own eyes. It's their self-claim of worth. That's one part of the equation. Does that make sense? First part is, honor is the self-claim of worth by the person. The second part of the equation is, honor is the value of the person in the eyes of his or her social group, the community. So, the equation of honor goes, the individual's claim of themselves, how much they believe they're worth, plus the community's claim of what they're worth, and this equals someone's honor. You can't eliminate one of those elements. They're both in tension. The synthesis of it then, so if I'm going to give a synthesized definition of honor, it would be, honor is, one, a person's claim to worth that is, two, acknowledged and confirmed by his or her social group. Honor is, one, a person's claim to worth that is, two, acknowledged and confirmed by his or her social group. That make sense? Honor, then, is communal. Honor is communal. The disbursement of honor is intricately interwoven into the community that that person exists in. As a matter of fact, if I was going to say what matters most in this equation is this. That's really the governing tool of all honor. And we'll get to the implications of that in just a bit. However, in the communal setting, you can receive honor, or you have honor, or the level of which honor is given to you comes in one of two ways. Number one, there is what is called ascribed honor. Ascribed honor. I don't know if I'm enunciating that in a way that makes sense. Ascribed honor. This is the honor that you passively receive. This is the honor that you just have because of who you were born to, because of what ethnicity you are, because of citizenship, because of things that you just, they are what they are because that's who you are. Does that make sense? Even gender, that's ascribed honor. Or, and the levels of that ascribed honor obviously vary. And so you could call it some of it ascribed shame. Nevertheless, really all that means, shame is you just have a smaller amount of honor. Yes?
Inherent honor?
It's just what you naturally, passively have. You didn't do anything to achieve it or earn it, or both good or bad. You just have it. It's what's ascribed to you. This is the reason why genealogies in the ancient world is so important. Because it actually establishes the worth that you have ascribed to you, the honor. The second way that you can achieve, or that you receive honor, not achieve, but that you receive honor, is called acquired honor. This is where you at the worth that you actually acquire by excelling over others in any given social interaction. Where this is achieved honor, acquired honor, that you actually gain. And this can be done in a variety of ways. For example, in the ancient world, money was not something to be accumulated. Money was merely a means to acquire more honor. That's one of the reasons why people had no problem going bankrupt through festivals, one big party. Because they didn't value the money, they valued the honor that the money could get them. Therefore, bankrupting an empire is not a big deal if it gains the empire honor. Is this making sense? Honor is always the chief goal. Yes? Of which one? Acquired honor? Worth that is acquired by excelling over others in any given social interaction. Excelling over others in any given social interaction. So you can achieve it through your wealth, or you can achieve it through joining a particular voluntary group, will either ascribe you honor or not, or you can achieve it through something called the challenge response honor game, and we'll get to the definition of that game here in a bit. But there are ways you can acquire honor, but there are drastic implications that go with that. In this equation, though, in this equation of the individual's perspective of their self-worth plus the communal's perspective of their self-worth equals their honor, it is a drastic mistake to overextend this. If your individual claim of your self-worth goes public and the public says, that's not who you are, all of a sudden now your overextension of who you think you are has been rebuked by the community, and you actually instead achieve shame. You see how that makes sense? The community says, actually, that's not who you are. You may have thought that's who you were, but it's not. And that you see that somewhat in our society as well. You'll have different interactions with many different people in which they just really think that they're better than what they really are. They just do. And it's really a public, that usually defenses come up the most whenever the community looks at them and says, actually, you're a moron. And all I have to do is give you 7 examples of when. In their society, though, overextending your self-understanding could be a death blow to the honor, not just of you, but of your entire community, which is one of the reasons why the community is the governing agent. As a result, since honor is so intricately woven to the communal understanding, the governing agent, this is kind of the ipso facto. It doesn't matter what you state here. If you overextend, they will correct you. It's a logical understanding, then, that the central unit of these honor-shame cultures, the central unit of worth, or the focal institution, if you will, is the family. The family is the center unit. Why? Because you all are sharing the same genealogy. You have the same ascribed honor. Therefore, anything you acquire benefits them as well. And this is the reason why that the organizing principle in these different communities is belongingness to your family. In the moment in which familial codes are broken, or the family rebukes you or even sets you outside of the family, is the moment in which in that honor society you cease to exist. If you don't, if you are disowned by your own family or your own town, there's nothing that can be more damning for your honor, because they are the ones that ascribe who is worth what. There's some major implications there with Jesus' ministry, by the way. Hopefully those connections will become clear through our presentations. Hey-o. It's happening next week. Is this making sense so far? Center family unit. As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. Mark Moore has told this illustration before, where his brother married a woman, an Asian woman, I believe, which is a very communal-based society as well. And he had a son, and one of the ways they would punish the son is they would lock him out of the house, sit him on the doorstep and lock the door. And the son would just sit there and be beating against the door and just sobbing and going crazy. And Mark's going, dude, if I was locked out, I'd be like, see ya, and just go and do what I want. But in a society in which belongingness is where you find your worth, to be locked outside is one of the worst things that could possibly happen to you. Because at that point, you cease to have the worth of the family. You cease to belong. You, in a sense, are bordering on ceasing to exist inside of the sociological structure. Therefore, outcasts. This is one of the things, when I'm talking in the Gospel of Mark, I consistently focus on, yes, the woman with the flow of blood did physically have some problems. But because of the fact that she was cultically unclean, she literally didn't have a community. And in a society of belongingness, what hurt her the most probably wasn't the physical reality, but the sociological one. And so whenever Jesus looks at her and he says, daughter, your faith has healed you. That one word, daughter, would have sent shockwaves in her, because no one has included her in any sort of family construct in years. 12 years, according to the text. You seeing the implications of that? Yes?
Okay, so like, what would something like that look like for us, like in American context? Like, what would like blow our mind? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Actually, I think that the effectiveness of a Matthew 18 still works. Does it really feel good whenever you walk into a room and you know that you're an outsider and no one's really going to be, you know, that you don't belong? Does that affect us any less? Just because our entire society really doesn't understand anything about this, and because they've eradicated this, we really have watered down this, doesn't mean that it still doesn't affect us on some level. I believe Matthew 18 is very, very a powerful tactic that I've used multiple times in my ministries. Even to the point where people threaten to sue because they don't want to be kicked out of the community. One of the best ways to develop this understanding is to start teaching community in the appropriate way in which the New Testament describes it. We don't understand community because we're so individualistic. And as a result, a lot of this falls on deaf ears. We need to reteach people how to function in a community. How to rely on each other. How what happens to you does affect me. And your sin does affect our community. But the problem is we've isolated ourselves from everybody else in so many different ways that we've completely lost both shame and honor. And it's one of the reasons why what we've got to do is not just accommodate our society. We've got to fight back against it. Because ultimately, I don't think that we'll even understand a lot of what the gospel means if we don't understand the concept of honor and shame. Does that make sense? Yeah?
So is that culture, honor, shame stuff, are they very emotionally based?
Define emotional.
Like a lot of the things that you know, we do in our culture is medicating things to deal with.
Is what now?
Is to medicate to deal with emotional issues, depression, and
okay.
Just things like that. Do they have major emotional breakdowns if there's honor, shame?
Yeah, they're still, I mean, they definitely have the same struggle with the same, I mean, they're human, you know what I mean? Like, they're going to struggle with the same thing. Now, the manifestation of the ways in which they struggle will come out differently. However, you ever thought about suicide bombers' psyche? They're not psychotic. They're functioning in honor and shame. Whenever the entire society treats, I'm driving down this particular area from a taxi, I'm coming from the airport in Egypt at this time, and this one, the taxi driver points over to the side and he says, "You see that over there?" And I looked over and there was this wall that's separating the street and where we were driving, and this, as far as the eye can see, just kind of these like weird looking small, what I thought were homes. And I said, "Yeah," and he said, "That's called the City of the Dead." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" He said, because literally people are so poor, they've built their houses on top of and inside of mausoleums. Crypts. And I was like, "Are you kidding me?" I said, that's disgusting. And he said, "Yeah, and that's actually the key breeding ground for Muslim extremists." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, whenever you have absolutely nothing to live for in this life and somebody comes and promises you honor for your family, and financial taking care of them, and in the afterlife, 40 virgins, what do you think they're going to do?" Suicide bombing doesn't make sense to us because we're so individualistic that it's all about survival of the fittest. For them, it's not about survival of the fittest. It's about how do we acquire honor. And whenever all of society is structured to where you can't acquire any honor because of what's been ascribed to you, you will go to drastic measures in order to secure some sort of honor for you and your group. And if your family will gain dignity by you becoming a martyr for the faith through suicide bombing, the more people you kill, the better you are in the honor system. See, it changes the way you think. They're not just psychotic morons. They're people in moments of desperation. You want to cure the war on terror? Cure poverty. All of a sudden, the breeding grounds isn't that ripe for the harvest. They just manifest what we feel in different ways. Nevertheless, we do the same things. Through our isolation, a lot of times it does end up moving into moments of violence. Happens all the time. Why is it that, you know, in the social networked world, we have so many kids that are committing suicide and depression at an increasing rate? I do believe in chemical imbalances, by the way. Don't think that I'm saying that some people literally just have a chemical imbalance that can be cured by medicine. I do believe that. Nevertheless, I will also say there are other people that's not the issue. Some of it has to do with this, some of it has to do with other things, etc. Is that making sense? It may manifest itself in different ways, yet it's still going to the root of the issue. But a guy that walks into a school and blows away 15 people and then kills himself kind of sounds like a suicide bomber to me. Making sense? Kamikazes are unthinkable in a nation that has no honor. But in Japan, that makes perfect sense because you bring honor to your group. Yeah.
What are some other social constructs besides time and money and honor and shame? Are there others?
Or these are the
only ones functioning on time and money. Would you say?
I'm sure you can have caveats or derivations of this. And as far as, yeah, I mean, in addition to those two primary systems, I don't know. I'm sure there's some. I'll be honest with you.
They're not really predominant.
Nor have I studied them.
Okay.
I mean, the ones I've studied the most are the ones that directly impact the Bible and the one that I'm a part of. But other missing, matter of fact, that's a good missions question. I'd maybe ask that question to Krista Weller or Wade Landers, who've had more experience around the world than I have. Yeah?
So, like the example of Mark's brother and his wife and their child, do they just communicate to themselves from a young age? You have to receive honor, and that's part of being this family unit. Or, I mean, how are kids raised with this desire to? Do they talk about honor the way we're talking about it now?
You know, this is sociological. A lot of this stuff's innate. The same way the individualism in us, nobody had to explain that to us. It's just naturally the way we are. Not because that's just how we were born, but because whenever we're young, we pick up on both verbal and nonverbal cues. And that's what shapes ultimately what we come to be. Therefore, no one had to explain to me verbally about individualism for me to struggle with it all throughout my life. Some of us have a natural propensities towards that. Some of it's just the latent propaganda that's just woven into all so many different things, like commercials, like everybody has to have their own individual personal laptops. That's what we cover. You know, I mean, it's woven into grammar. It's woven into the way that we treat each other. One of the things I talk to my kids a lot about, though, is, and granted, I won't be able to totally diffuse the individualism that's rampant in our society. But one of the things I talk to my son whenever he does something is I say, you know that we do not act like that in our family. You belong to our family. And our family does not treat people like that. And whenever you act like that, and I don't ever use the words, but basically the point is you shame both yourself and us. And that is not appropriate. So have I added some honor shame? Yeah, absolutely. One of the best things that you can instill in kids is a sense of shame. Kids do not respond well to just rules and breaking the rules. What they respond well is if they've disappointed the one they love. And so, honestly, a lot of times the way I discipline my oldest son is I look at him and just say, buddy, that just breaks my heart. Why would you treat your mom like that? Do you know how much I love your mom? Those moments are more impacting. And what I'm doing is I'm instilling this sense. If you actually care about the name that you wear, it'll make you act different in all different contexts. Because whenever I act moronically, it doesn't just reflect poorly on me, but on my parents and on my brothers and on my grandparents. It really does have communal effects. It's kind of the same thing that we wrestle with all the time whenever Christians don't act like Christians. If we'd be more concerned about honor, we'd be all over Christians in our community to start acting like good Christians. Why? Because what you do, we all pay for. You wear the same name. But we act like Jesus just took away my individual sins, therefore individual sins only affect the individual. Well, that's just dumb. That's bad theology. Doesn't make sense in their society, nor in the New Testament explanation, I think, of what Jesus even did. Okay, we're going to need to keep moving so we can actually progress somewhat. I hope you're following me so far, though, right? Are we developing this? I want to talk about the challenge and response honor game that occurs in their societies. Basically, this is the kind of the technical definition, but it'll become more clear once I define certain the four phases of this game. The technical definition, it's a social pattern or a game. Game not in the sense of like Milton Bradley, but in the sense of everybody kind of knows the rules of the game and you got to play it, but everybody knows it's not really a fun game to play. Making sense? A social pattern or a game in which persons hassle each other according to socially defined rules in order to gain the honor of another. This is the battle for acquired honor. So a social pattern or game in which persons hassle each other according to socially defined rules. It's not just random hassling. Socially defined rules in order to gain the honor of another, to acquire their honor, to take it from them. Before we understand the game, we have to talk about two caveats of honor. And the first one is this. Honor is a limited resource. Just because it is abstract, it is tempting for us to think that there is enough to go around, and that's just not true. Honor like money, honor like crops, honor like other resources is a limited commodity. And as a result, people will fight for it because there's not enough to go around for everybody. Does that make sense? If you look at honor as in it's because it's abstract, there's tons of it, you don't understand the honor game. Honor is a limited commodity. And when some people gains honor, that means someone else is losing it. It's an limited commodity. Number two, honor is always at stake. If you don't understand these two caveats, you won't understand the whole game. Honor is a limited commodity. Honor is always at stake. Every time there's an interaction with a non-family member, every time an interaction with a non-family member, honor is up for grabs. It can be lost or gained. Yes?
I somehow missed the definition of the game. Like it's a
social pattern or game in which persons hassle each other according to socially defined rules in order to gain the honor of another. And say it again?
What is that, the
That's the definition of the challenge response honor game. Challenge response honor game. That's the technical definition. The two caveats are, number one, honor is a limited commodity, a limited resource, and honor is always at stake. And when you have those two things in place, you'll understand why the game emerges at all. Okay? Every time there's an interaction, honor can be lost or gained with somebody on the outside of your community. So the honor game progresses in four phases then. With those two caveats in place, the honor game progresses in four phases. Number one, there is the challenge that occurs. The challenge happens, and it can happen through either words, it can happen through deeds, or it can happen through both, the combination of both. And a challenge in some way, shape, or form is extended publicly. Why is publicly such an important caveat or important element of that? Yeah, because of the because of the equation. Because ultimately, the community is going to be the one that defines who gets what honor. Think of the kiosk guy that goes running down here. He understands the equation, and that's why for him the time and money can be expended so he can go and divvy out what the community is supposed to divvy out. Who the honor goes to. But there has to be a challenge extended. Number two, the second phase, is then the perception of the message has to be established. The perception. A legitimate challenge, and here's the explanation of that. A legitimate challenge can only occur between social equals. A legitimate challenge can only occur between social equals. And you see this sometimes. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Let's just keep going. As a result of the fact that you can only be between social equals, the number one, and this is one caveat of the perception of the message, the crowd and the receiver of the challenge have to determine the honor or the worth of the person giving the challenge. So you have a person over here that offers a challenge, phase one. Phase two, the crowd here in the middle and the person receiving the challenge has to determine the value of that person so that it can determine how they will respond. Because if that person is not an equal, then you can respond in a way that is directly shameful for them. For example, between slave and masters. That is not social equals. Therefore, if the slave offers a challenge, then the master can respond by merely beating the slave. That can be his response. But if they're social equals, that is not the way in which the guy can respond. Because it will actually be shameful for him to do something violent against somebody that's his social equal. Does that make sense? So, it has to actually, you have to determine the value of the person giving the challenge so that then you know how to respond. The second thing is you have to really even determine if it was a challenge at all. You have to perceive the message. Maybe it was something inadvertent. Maybe, because these are the different areas in which an honor challenge can happen. If somebody gives a gift, that can be an honor challenge. Because what if the gift that you gave someone was not really worthy of who they were? Then in a sense, you're slighting them by categorizing them with your gift where you perceive them. And that may need to, that may demand a response. Invitations to dinner can be a challenge, especially if you should deserve the position of honor, but instead, you're not given any honor at the dinner at all. At that point, the invitation to the dinner was not something that you're, hey, you're at least you're part of the group. You were part of the group so that your honor could be taken. Debates over theology and law in the public could be develop into a challenge. Arranging of marriages could be considered a sociological challenge. Why? Because do you really think Prince William, it'd be honorable for him to find a pauper to marry? No. Because you don't cross lines like that whenever you have a society that's based on ascribed honor. You stay with equal. It's kind of a not exactly, but it's a form of caste system, although it's much different all at the same time. Also, another way in which a challenge could happen is a compliment. Could be considered an honor challenge. As a matter of fact, compliments were considered acts of aggression in the ancient world. Somebody, matter of fact, this may even explain somewhat of the, you know, the rich young ruler saying, "Good teacher," and Jesus says, "Now, why do you call me good? But why, I thought only God alone was good. Why are you calling me that? Where are you challenging me?" Because even compliments be good, because a compliment could be looking at the person and saying, "Man, you're actually rising above the level of your ascribed honor group. And if you rise above that, that means you're a threat not only to your own group, to everybody else." Why? Because honor is a limited commodity. And if you are rising above the level of honor of your group, that means you're taking honor away from somewhere, from someone. So somebody comes along and they'd say, "Man, you were the absolute best. You don't teach like any of the other rabbis at all." That could be threatening you. Because ultimately, the other rabbis who own this honor could be losing something, some of their honor to somebody that's just risen above the level that their group is supposed to be at. And that could be a threatening moment. So one of the ways in which, for example, like if I'm walking by the emperor, and there happens to be a guy there, and I look at him and you say, "Man, buddy, you're right. You have the best administrative mind that this world's ever seen, and best military mind. No one's better than you." What have you just done to him? Yeah, now he's a threat to the emperor, and that very compliment may not have been a compliment at all. It may have been a means of you to undercut his honor and get him physically in some sort of harm's way. Compliments may not always be compliments. They may be a way of putting you in a position where you can have wrath rain down on you. It's kind of like we were just talking about the other day, Jacob, whenever you get your hair cut, people are like, "Oh, I love you, look so good, so much better, you look so great." And you're going, "Okay, you just complimented me and backhanded me at the same time. Can I really say that was a compliment? Whenever you just said the whole time you were existing, I didn't really like the way you looked, but now you look acceptable." It's one of the reasons why I don't want to cut my hair, because I'm never going to get that. I know that's going to happen. And people, in that situation, there's not vindictiveness behind it. And again, that's the whole point of this phase. When a compliment is given, the perception of the comp or the message or the challenge has to be determined by the group. Was that really a legitimate compliment? Or was there a challenge that's just been issued? Is it making sense? Is this making sense? Yes?
What about like sarcasm? What if you say like, "Oh yeah, you're really good at that"? Like,
even voice inflection then sometimes can be considered an honor challenge. You see what I mean? "Oh yeah, man, you're the best teacher I've ever had." Nonverbal cues sometimes are more important than what I'm actually saying. Therefore, if I'm just reading a text and I'm not actually seeing what's between the lines, Paul uses sarcasm in 1 Corinthians, doesn't he? When he's talking to the church in Corinth and he says, "Oh, you guys, what do you need the apostles for? Compared to you, we're worthless. That I were as wise as you, Church of Corinth." If you just read the text, you're going, "Man, Corinth must be really getting it together." But if you actually see what could be happening behind, and that's why one of the problems is with text is you don't get to see and you don't get to hear what is happening, and therefore it becomes a little more difficult to determine what is occurring in the text. And sociology comes in and says, "Let's add some color. What are possibilities here?" It's one of the reasons why I possibly think, I don't know if I'll say this or not. Yeah, I'll say it. I think it's possible that Paul laying down all the requirements for tongues in 1 Corinthians is the same way of him saying you're not supposed to be speaking in tongues like that at all. The reason why, because I think the people at the end of it, they would go, well, if I have to do all this and I can't speak in the tongues the way I'm speaking in, and he would just go, that's too bad. You see what I mean? How do I get that? Well, he starts off the letter with sarcasm, and he also does it three chapters later. And to think that he just abandons that tactic all the way throughout, well, that has to be a leap either way. Nevertheless, what I can say is that the way in which they are practicing tongues is never found anywhere else in the New Testament in the same manner. The unintelligible, you don't see that in Acts. It's very intelligible. Therefore, I think the caveats he puts in, he could be sarcastically saying, okay, you want to speak in tongues? That's fine. Go ahead. Speak in tongues. But if you're going to speak in tongues, then you got to speak in it like this. And they get to the end, they're going, well, nah, I can't speak in tongues at all the way I am. Oh, I'm sorry, that's too bad. Got to read between the lines. Okay. The third phase. Yes?
Kind of along that line, yep. Like when he's talking about that, he's also, the entire time, he's like saying, well, it's better if you were prophesying anyways. So, like, as he's talking about those tongues, he's kind of ascribing the honor to the prophecy side of it as well.
Yeah, right in the middle of this whole tongues discussion, it's predicated on, it's led into by the whole chapter on love. Mm-hmm. Right? The whole thing, it leads into it. It's saying, this is the point. And then you get there, and you're, matter of fact, and this is, there's a difference between the indicative and the subjunctive that could change, we don't have time for that. That could change even the definition, or the way in which we read the message at the end of chapter 12. I think he interprets the passage more correctly than what we find in pretty much every other translation. Anyway, we don't have time for that. But 1 Corinthians, people need to think through that. The third point, the third movement in the honor or the challenge response game is that the response by the recipient of the challenge. Oh yeah, is that once the challenge is extended, once it's been determined that it is a challenge. By the way, no response is a response. So if the person is not equal to you, then you not responding to them is a response. Because what you're saying is you're not even worthy of me stooping down to speak to you. Therefore, why would I? However, if you make the mistake and don't respond to someone that is your equal, then that makes you look shameful because people would say you can't handle his objection, his challenge. So the second phase is so important of determining if it is a challenge and if it is done between equals. Yes, I'm having tons of hands. What did I say?
Jesus responding with a question or not responding. I know most people view him as a teacher, but by his, ascribed honor, he was not as important as the Pharisees.
Yeah, what good can come out of Nazareth?
So then would that be an instance where he would have overinflated his individual worth of honor and then be viewed as shameful?
Yeah, why does his family come in Mark chapter 3 to take him away because he's clearly crazy? What are they trying to do? Protect their family honor. He is saying he's the Son of God. And I don't know if there's anything more you can say that would overextend an individual claim. So his own community is coming to say, I know everybody doesn't think that's what he is. It's because he's crazy. That's why. They're trying to protect themselves. Because what Jesus is doing is shameful for their whole group. And then Jesus looks at him and says, who's my mother and who's my brothers? Oh my gosh. You can't say anything in a society more that's more outrageous than that. There were seven other hands. Yes.
Would they not know what to do with him then after he did that because he takes himself out of his family unit so he's not connected to him?
Notice consistently, though, what the community around him, the crowds around him, are trying to figure out. This is his claim. Is he right? That's where they're constantly confused. We've never seen anybody talk like this before. And what the community is trying to decide is this part of the equation. Do we affirm this? Or do we deal with it the way we deal with this? Ultimately, what they do, they actually have a change of heart, triumphal entry. They affirm what he's been saying, Hosanna. And by the end of it, they say, actually, let's say crucify him. Those are key points of the text because this is what matters most in the equation. So Jesus is making these claims. His family responds by saying, that's ridiculous. But the rest of the community is confused. They don't know how to handle him yet. But they figure it out. Somebody like this, we just got to kill. He's a liability to everyone. Even the high priest Caiaphas says that. It's better to kill one person and to save a whole nation than to let that guy keep on going around and get our whole nation under the eyes of Rome. Let's just kill him, get rid of it, and move on. That's a very honor-based... The individual doesn't matter very much in an honor system. The individual only matters in so much as they contribute honor to the community and protect the honor that's been ascribed to that community. And if that individual tries to... Progression in an honor system could be very threatening for the whole community. Because it's also shameful. You're, in a sense, you're saying, I'm beyond this community. I'm better than that. And the whole community back here is going, you're better than what now? We have this even today. Have you ever ministered in an agricultural society? People, even though they may hate everything about where they're at in their life, they won't leave. Because leaving would say that to their family that the location that you've established, that the community you developed, isn't good enough for me. Happens all the time. Just in different contexts. Yes?
So within this, Christianity would be shaming the entire nation of Israel.
Oh yeah. This is one of the reasons why the stuff that Israel or that Christianity is saying, whenever Christianity says we are a holy nation, a royal priesthood, that's both shaming for the Romans and for the Jews. And whenever you shame, it's not something just to say, oh, that might have just contradicted a bit. No. If you're saying my kingdom's not of this world, if you're saying my God is the God over the whole universe, I don't care what you claim. My God really is this. That's shaming. Those are fighting words. And there's only so many ways, if there's only so much honor to go around, and you're claiming an honor that extends what the community thinks you should have, or what your group should have, that's got to be dealt with. Eventually it has to be dealt with. You can't let this keep going, because there's only so much honor to go around. Okay, I want to finish up the challenge response game. The third phase is the response by the recipient of the challenge. How does the person that receives the challenge respond? We've already gone to this a little bit. A non-response is a response. They can respond directly. They can respond indirectly. For example, one of the ways they may respond indirectly is try to shame their disciples, as a way of showing the people that follow them are foolish, therefore and if they are an extension of that person, then ultimately that person's not as honorable as what everybody claims for them to be. The response, though, by the recipient is something that the whole crowd will be looking for, and that moves us into phase four. Phase four is the evaluation by the public. After you have the challenge, it's determined what kind of challenge it is. Then you have the third phase, the response. Then, after the response, the public then gives the results of the honor game. This is one of the reasons why whenever you see in the Gospel of Mark, you'll have this conflict between Jesus and the teachers of the law, the Pharisees. And right after that, almost every time right after that, it'll start talking about the crowds that are just flocking to Jesus. Why? He's giving the results of the honor game. Mark chapter 3, you have the Sabbath controversy where they set a trap for him. Will he heal the man with the shriveled hand? And Jesus asks him a question. Is it okay to do, or is what's better? To do good on the Sabbath or evil? And how do they respond? Silence. Why? Maybe they thought he wasn't worthy enough to respond to. Maybe they didn't have a response. And so it says, and Jesus was distressed, enraged. He said, all right, fine. Your hand's healed. The guy stretches out his hand. All of a sudden, the crowds, eventually they go, what kind of guy is this? He does miracles. And what does it say in verse 6 that the teachers of the law and the Herodians want to do? They start to plot to figure out a way to kill him. Why? He's just taken honor that he's shamed them. And one of the ways of responding to whenever honor has been taken away from you, if it's so bad, the only way sometimes that you can even get the honor back is by killing the person that's taken the honor from you. This is one of the reasons why whenever people will leave their families in the Middle Eastern world, you hear about this, to go to the Western world, and they'll live there, and 20 years later they come back, and immediately upon seeing them, the family kills them. It's because for 20 years they've been living in a state in which their honor was in, literally the word is, in desecration. And until that wrong has been righted, they are literally in a perpetual state of desecration according to their honor. But the moment that they take care of the problem, that's the moment they get all their honor back. In an honor-shame society, the individual is not as important as the group. Therefore, if an individual leaves the group, that's shaming the whole group, and the group's got to deal with it eventually. Is this making sense? We're going to keep dialoguing about this so that we can continue to understand the world that the Bible is being written in. But we will probably be doing it throughout the discussions at the end of your presentations. Does that make sense? I have the rest of these notes here, and I'm going to filter them throughout. I'm going to say, okay, because we talk about Philemon, we're going to talk about some patron-client relationship stuff. We're going to do stuff like that. Does that make sense? You are only required to know for the oral exam tomorrow what we got up to. Therefore, everything after the seven key characteristics of a person in the Honor Shame Society, we didn't go over that today. You won't need to know that for tomorrow. Okay? You will not be asked a question we didn't go over. All right, make sure you know when you're supposed to come for the oral exam. It's on the website. Any questions, let me know. Love you. See you tomorrow.